Dublab. Welcome to episode 2 of the Care Talk Radio Hour, broadcasting live from the Dublab Studios in Los Angeles, California. Care Talk is an interactive storytelling project that amplifies and connects caregivers working on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm your host, Michael Rippins. My guest for today's show is Professor of Ethnic Studies and Associate Dean of the College of Letters and Sciences Division of Undergraduate Studies at UC Berkeley. Her specialties include Asian American history, Filipino American studies, race, gender, and migration, nursing history, and adoption studies. She's author of the award-winning book, Empire of Care, Nursing and Migration in Filipino American History, which explores how and why the Philippines became the leading exporter of professional nurses to the United States. Professor Catherine Siniza Choi, welcome to Care Talk.
Thank you. Welcome for having me, Michael. And it's great to be here on Dublab.
Great. Now, we're just going to get right into it. According to the Migration Policy Institute, nearly 1 in 3 foreign-born nurses in the U.S. are Filipino. And in L.A. County, the California Healthcare Foundation reports that Filipinos make up nearly 30% of the total nursing force. So you can probably anticipate my question, but why are there so many Filipino nurses?
That's an excellent question, and those are really incredible statistics. In my book, Empire of Care, I explored how and why the Philippines became the world's leading sending country of nurses. And historically, the major destination for Filipino nurses has been to the United States. Since 1960, over 150,000 Filipino nurses have migrated to the U.S., and even though this seems like a contemporary phenomenon, a historical perspective lets us know that this is actually a much longer history. And it begins with the early 20th century and the formal U.S. colonization of the Philippines from 1898 to 1946. U.S. colonialism was controversial, and one of the ways that colonizers justified doing this to the Philippines was through a policy of benevolent assimilation, where the U.S. was coming to the Philippines as friends as opposed to invaders. But this was also a violent history, but it was also accompanied by Americanized education in the Philippines, and that included Americanized nursing education in the Philippines, which U.S. colonizers brought, as well as training in the English language. And so this kind of Americanized nursing training plus English language fluency created preconditions for Filipino nurses to work in the United States. And after World War II, when we started to see critical nursing shortages here in the United States, American hospital recruiters turned to the Philippines to recruit nurses there because of this legacy of U.S. colonialism. And these nursing shortages, especially in public inner city hospitals in various parts of the United States, these shortages only increased in the second half of the 20th century with the passage of Medicaid and Medicare, which made health coverage more available to elderly and poor populations here in the United States. And so there was an increased demand of nursing services. This coincided with other social movements that enabled American women to seek professional opportunities beyond nursing. Mm-hmm. So there was that. And then there were also new immigration legislation, like the Immigration Act of 1965, which created occupational preferences that enabled nurses who were in demand, nurses to immigrate to the United States. So all of these things come together. And we find ourselves today with, as I was saying, more than 150,000 Filipino nurses in the United States who have now worked for six decades here.
Well, I was wondering, you had mentioned kind of these larger political and colonial factors. Is there something unique about Filipinos that make us good nurses and caregivers, kind of culturally or intrinsically?
Yes, that's a fascinating question. But I think what makes Filipino nurses unique is precisely this history of U.S. colonialism in the Philippines, is precisely this Americanized nursing education and English language fluency. And when I was doing research, and even today on this topic, I do hear people, both Filipinos and non-Filipinos, saying that Filipino nurses are intrinsically or essentially caring. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes them the best caregivers. And I understand this to be an expression of pride, you know, in the work of Filipino nurses, which I think is really important. But I also think to say that Filipino nurses are essentially good caregivers is also problematic because it takes away their hard work and training to become a nurse and to gain these skills. And it also downplays this history of U.S. colonization, which inadvertently prepared Filipino nurses to work here in the United States. So another thing is, sometimes I feel that when people say, you know, Filipino nurses are the best caregivers, it pits them against non-Filipino nurses.
Right.
So Filipino nurses are excellent nurses, but what makes them unique is this historical relationship between the United States and the Philippines.
So, Professor Choi, how did you first become interested in exploring, you know, this relationship between Filipino immigrants and nursing? Was there like a personal experience or a connection that inspired your journey?
Yes, there was definitely a personal experience. Many people assume that my mother or another close family member was or is a nurse. Mm-hmm. But actually, my immediate family, I'm the daughter of Filipino immigrants, and I was born and raised in New York City. And my immediate family actually is, they aren't nurses. But my personal connection is that as a second generation Filipino American growing up in New York City, I learned, you know, at a relatively young age that the most visible community member in the Filipino immigrant community was the Filipino nurse. And I got to know these nurses who lived in my apartment building and who worked in the surrounding neighborhood. I grew up in New York City in a neighborhood that was surrounded by a cluster of hospitals, Beth Israel Hospital, New York Eye and Ear, and Bellevue Hospital. And so I got to know these Filipino nurses as community members, as family friends. And so they were never solely workers or laborers to me. They were, you know, full-fledged members of our community, and who I remember from conversations they would have with my mom in the apartment building, or you know around the building, and I have fond memories of them. So as I think about the times that we're in and the devastating toll that this pandemic has taken on Filipino nurses, it's heartbreaking for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, was there something as you kind of started this process and research that turned into your, you know, your book, was there something you discovered that really maybe surprised you, or a story you heard that that stuck with you?
Yeah, there's so many. so many surprises. And I really like that question, because I think for people who are interested in doing research, you know, the things that surprise you are often the most productive or interesting aspects of your research. So there are a couple of things that surprised me. The first thing that surprised me was when I was interviewing Filipino nurses. I interviewed over 40 Filipino nurses who had trained as nurses in the Philippines, but who were working as registered nurses in American hospitals. And the majority of them were working in hospitals in New York City. That's where I'm from. And New York City, similar to Southern California and really the state of California, there's a large percentage of Filipino RNs who are working in New York City. Back in the 90s, that percentage was like almost 18%, wow, you know, already of the RN staff in New York City hospitals. And when I was doing the secondary research, you know, when I was reading books and articles about why there were foreign trained nurses in the United States, including Filipino nurses, you know, most of the findings tended to focus on economic reasons, mm-hmm, you know, in terms of like earning so much more money in the United States as opposed to the home country, in this case, the Philippines. And so I asked all of my interview subjects, you know, why did you take up nursing and why did you, you know, eventually migrate to the United States? And I expected, you know, their answers to be economic. But I was surprised that a number of nurses had entered the profession because they loved the nursing uniform, especially the older, you know, the more iconic uniform of the white nursing cap and gown.
Yeah.
And we tend to think of fashion maybe, you know, or what we're wearing as something superficial. But this was very meaningful for a number of them, because that white uniform and that white cap in the Philippines, they associated that with high education, with respect, with medical training. And many of them also had good experiences with Filipino nurses in their community, in their schools, when they were growing up. And so this sort of awesome reaction and feeling about the uniform, because it was more than a uniform, it was really about professional respect. So I was surprised by that, but I thought it was because I was expecting a more economic answer. Right. But I think it gets to the cherished associations that people, including nurses, have of nurses, and how important caregiving is to their lives and to what they hope to accomplish, you know, by helping other people. The other thing I was surprised by was when I asked them, you know, why would you migrate, you know, to the United States? I mean, that's such a big thing, a big decision. And a number of them, again, I was expecting a more economic response, but a number of them had told me that they came to the United States because when they were growing up in the Philippines, they were so exposed to American culture from not solely their nursing education, but their childhood education. And they learned, you know, A is for apple when apples don't grow in the Philippines. You know, they learned about ice skating and they wanted to see snow because they read about that in childhood books, even though it doesn't snow in the Philippines.
Right.
And so they came to the United States to see and experience these things on the ground, you know, eating apples, experiencing the cold and the snow and perhaps ice skating. And some of them were really struck by, you know, what we would call American soft power also, which is like the attraction of Hollywood and Broadway musicals. And so some of these Filipino nurses who, very similar to my mom, who's not a nurse, but also immigrated in the 1960s, you know, my mom really wanted to see Broadway musicals and experience that. And so these cultural reasons for migration, which are also connected to the history of U.S. colonialism in the Philippines, are part of the motivation, in addition to, of course, the very important economic motivation for immigrating, working, and settling here. But those were some of the things that surprised me. And the final thing I'll say about what surprised me is that I think there's this stereotype of Filipino nurses as being submissive and quiet and, you know, not speaking up. And one of the things that I learned from my research for Empire of Care is that there is a longstanding history of Filipino immigrant activism in the United States. And this activism includes organizing so that Filipino nurses could have companionship, but also so that they could increase their visibility here in the United States as a foreign-trained immigrant workforce. And this activism included standing up for Filipino immigrant nurses and other migrants when there were fraudulent recruitment practices, when there was racial scapegoating in the United States, when there were cases of discrimination, you know, ranging from English-only pressures in the workforce to issues of being demoted due to, you know, English-only pressures in the hospital workforce. And every Filipino nurse I interviewed who was working here, you know, said, we speak English, you know, when we're on the job, right? When we're right. on the work shift, because that's the professional, that's the right thing to do. But by English-only pressures, I'm talking about when they're on their break or when they're on a personal phone call. You know, as immigrants, a Filipino language like Tagalog or, you know, Ilocano could be their first language. And they would feel more comfortable speaking that sometimes with one another or during a break or, you know, on a phone call. So when they were speaking out against English-only pressures, it had to do with those moments where they believe, and I support them in this, that we're, you know, a multiracial, multicultural nation. We're a multilingual nation. Mm-hmm. And language, Filipino language is beautiful and it's important.
Great. On that note, Professor Choi, I just want to remind our listeners that they're tuned in to the Care Talk Radio Hour. And I'm speaking with Professor Catherine Siniza Choi. And we are coming to you live from the Dub Lab Studios in Los Angeles, California. And I'd be remiss to be broadcasting live from Dub Lab without playing some great music. So we're going to move into to a song, and we'll be back in a minute. Okay. Key organizations working to support and advocate for caregivers is the Filipino Workers Center of Southern California, a nonprofit serving and organizing the low-wage Filipino immigrant community in Los Angeles. I recently had a phone conversation with Aquilina Soriano Versosa, founder and current executive director of the Filipino Workers Center, or PWC. Aquilina also serves as the current president of the board of directors of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, co-chair of the Filipino Voter Empowerment Project, and has been chosen as one of the Frederick Douglass 200 abolitionists. Here's Aquilina speaking about her work with the PWC.
The Filipino Workers Center, we were founded back in 1997. I'm one of the founders because we saw that there were organizations that were focused on issues of youth, issues of seniors, but there wasn't really anything for Filipino workers. So one of the places that we found where there are so many Filipinos working in jobs that are precarious, and most of them are immigrants stepping into those jobs, and our low-wage jobs are in caregiving. We started looking for folks in the restaurants, working in restaurants and Filipino groceries, and we soon learned that even folks working there, their part-time gig outside is caregiving, or they started as caregivers here, or their fallback will be caregiving. So there's just so many working in the caregiving industry that we were reaching out to that became a big one of our biggest focus right now. And so we're an organization that's looking to address and improve the lives of workers by building leadership and strategies to transform the industry so that caregiving, the work that they're doing, is valued. We address real immediate needs with services, workforce trainings, assisting with job searches, depending on our capability. We're developing a home care cooperative agency, as well as advocating for policy change, like advocating for workers' rights and equal workers' rights for caregivers, like all other workers, as well as advocating that the society needs to be investing in the care infrastructure so that everyone who needs care can afford care and that they can afford to pay their caregivers what they deserve also. What we think, because it's fundamentally thought of as women's work, it's been fundamentally devalued in our society. And a lot of our struggles with legislators and other policymakers is to get them to see that this work, real work, and it's actually real work that is a basic foundation of our society, that so many things in our society would not function if we did not have this work, both the family caregivers and the paid professional. So, and that's a society infrastructure that needs to be invested in for all of us. Kind of at the core, the root of the problem of the issues that caregivers face is that the work is devalued. So, and they don't have equal protections under the law. In the 1930s, when a lot of labor rights were being established, domestic workers and farm workers were excluded from those protections, like the Fair Labor Standards Act. And this wasn't because it's not real work, but it's because the Southern legislators did not want to shift the racial and economic existing structures in the South, which was not long out of slavery, and they actually proposed to exclude all African Americans from labor protections. When that was not acceptable, they said, we'll do the next best thing. Let's compromise where they're mostly working is in domestic work and in the fields. So domestic work and farm work got excluded from basic minimum wage, 8-hour day protections, overtime protections, all of those. So a lot of the struggle has been to get recognition of equal rights. Some of those rights were recognized back in the 1970s, but more for housekeepers and not as much for nannies and caregivers. We only got overtime protections, for example, for caregivers who are working one-on-one in individual homes, which is under the umbrella of domestic workers, in 2014. And that was after, our first attempt was back in 2006 to legislatively have those overtime rights recognized. And it took, until 2014 for us to actually win that with the California Bill of Rights. So what that translates to, the undervaluing of the work is and not having equal protections is very high rates of wage theft. So a lot of caregivers are not being paid what they should be paid. Some of them are paid minimum wage, but not all of their hours are counted. And that especially happens with live-in workers who in reality are on duty and on call around the clock, but a lot of times are only paid for a certain amount of hours during the daytime. And that's been starting to transform, however. And then others are being paid less than minimum wage. We have very recent cases of caregivers being paid around $5 an hour or even $2.50 per hour. And so what that means is that the caregivers are really subsidizing the care infrastructure by working for less than legal wages. So, and they don't have their own health insurance that comes along with their work. They don't have a lot of security also because you know, if their client passes away, then it's like just finding another, you know, client, and you don't know how long this is going to take. It depends on if the family might give something or not. It could just be suddenly you're out of work. And for some of those who are live-in, it could also mean suddenly you're out of a place to live as well. In 2020, we were fighting for a bill to include domestic workers under the protections of Cal OSHA, because right now domestic workers are excluded. And then this year it took on new life with the pandemic, because domestic workers and especially caregivers for elders and those with disabilities, they're essential workers. Still, you know, for some of the nannies, a lot of the nannies lost their jobs because people were staying home and with their children. But for caregivers, a lot of them really still needed to work because there is no one else to care for them, because their families are far away or for many different reasons. And because they're not in a health facility or structure that can, like, put in policies and procedures, is really, you know, caregivers are trying to figure out, like, as they're working, how do they actually protect themselves and protect their clients, especially when so many of them have to travel using public transportation as immigrants. And a lot of them do see different clients. And if they're not with their clients, a lot of times they live in really crowded housing conditions with a lot of times other caregivers. So those are places that we've seen that, you know, also then they have no good way to quarantine if they were exposed because of the crowded housing conditions, because they don't have wages that are high enough to live in better living conditions. So the bill, it received a lot of support in Sacramento and made it all the way to the governor's desk. The governor did veto it, but since then we've been able to, because he had still a lot of questions about it, how this would actually work with individual households. He did not sit down with us before the veto, but we have been able to sit down with the governor in his office in December. And so we are going to be reintroducing the bill this year, it looks like, with the support of the governor. So, and part of it is just they recognize how critical the role of caregiving is in California in this pandemic. And caregiving is one of the fastest growing jobs in not only California, in the United States. And the governor just did his master plan on aging, because we have this huge boom. We've had this huge boom of boomers, you know, who have been coming into retirement ages. And so the need for care has been growing exponentially. And it is really a crisis that's there in terms of access to long-term care. And most people, of course, want to age in their own communities and in their own homes, but we don't have a robust infrastructure to support that and to support equity, because it shouldn't just be if you're very rich, you can do that. A domestic worker that retires should be able to do that as well. You know, we've been building slowly, but one of our big victories was actually winning the California Domestic Worker Bill of Rights and ending 75 years of exclusion. And we had a big fight with the governor then. That was Governor Brown. He did not recognize the value of caregiving. And it was really through the power of our organizing and organizing influential people around him that we were able to win that. And so he grudgingly signed the California Domestic Worker Bill of Rights. And we were called the night before saying there's going to be a signing, but they didn't want it to be a big public signing. But we mobilized domestic workers from all around California to be there on that day with the governor when he was going to sign it. And when he walked into the room, he was very, his attitude was very kind of bored and disinterested. And so he came in, and then the governor signed the bill, held it up, clicked, took a picture, put it down, and then he got up. Then he just stood up to leave. And at that moment, the workers surrounded him. And they were like, tears in their eyes. And I remember one of our leaders who was there, Amelia, she was there shaking his hand. And they're all like saying how grateful they were and how, that they have these rights now, and thanking the governor for signing it, and how much of a difference it was going to make in their lives, and how also the process, they also gained dignity for themselves because they're standing up for their rights. So like even their stature in their families and communities changed. So they were telling him all of these things and shaking his hands. And then you could see it really shifted the governor and his attitude. He connected with people, the workers, and his face changed, and so he started listening and engaging with them and listened to them and responded. And then as he was walking out, we heard later that he said, "No, I think we should be working more with these people," with them. "We need people to work with," something like that. And his, you know, and he's like, yes, you know. So that was, you know, something with the work themselves and their sincerity really helped to transform some of his thinking. So that was just a really powerful moment. We actually were able to hire almost 50 of our members to become community health workers for a couple months to do COVID prevention, outreach, and education, and systems navigation. And you know, and they're all caregivers. They work either full or part time, and they said just being able to use a different part of their brain and different skills to talk to people, hear their stories, and then be able to provide some real help and make a real impact on that person was really great for their own mental health and well-being too. A lot of caregivers, while they're still working, some of them have lost hours or lost one of their clients, because a lot of the families only want them to stay with one and not to go to another client, but not necessarily being able to pay more, have more hours. So for a lot of caregivers, their wages are less. And then a lot of them are paying more for transportation, trying to avoid public transportation. So paying for like Uber and Lyft. And so we're doing a lot of cash assistance. We're doing a lot of housing assistance, helping people connect to testing and care because they don't have health insurance if they are positive. And even we've been having town halls and connecting them to some experts, some doctors who can help them think through their situation about what's the best way to deal with their situation if they're exposed, if they are positive, when they can go back to work. And we're doing a lot of housing right now because everyone lives in such crowded situations that when they're positive, and we've had a surge since the New Year's of new positive cases and yesterday. We found out that we lost like three different people. One of them are members, one of them a former intern, and one of them one of our close allies in another organization who worked with domestic workers too. So, and last week we lost another member as well. So it's been very intense and it's been hard. Yeah, we've lost way too many people in this pandemic. I feel really grateful, though, that we've been able to build PwC to as a way to get resources to the community, especially to caregivers and to immigrants in our community. We've been able to leverage. I think we've helped with over $3 million of cash assistance into the community, and we are actually really building power. We are actually really making change. Over the years, we're seeing standards rise. There's still many, many problems, but we've won over $1 million in back wages for Filipino caregivers. It's the workers themselves that are my inspiration, because they really have the drive to work and reach out to others so that they're not in an isolated situation, and supporting people. And it's just been a really beautiful community that's been growing. So I'm just feeling very blessed to be a part of it.
Leave me alone until tomorrow. No, I can't explain. Just leave the way you came. You take all you can beg, steal or borrow, showing no regret. You just take what you can get. You pay
You're listening to the Care Talk Radio Hour, broadcasting live from Dublab Studios. We just heard from Aquilina Soriano-Vasosa, founder and current executive director of the Filipino Workers Center of Southern California. I'd like to welcome back Professor Catherine Siniza Choi of UC Berkeley and author of Empire of Care, Nursing and Migration in Filipino-American History. Hi, Professor.
Hi, Michael. Good to still be here, and that was a really powerful segment with Aquilina Soriano Verzosa of the Filipino Workers Center.
Yeah, I just wanted to get your take, if you wanted to comment on anything that Aquilina spoke about.
Oh, there's so many things that were going through my mind as I was listening to what she was saying. One of the things that I thought about was how there's this perception, a misperception, of the Filipino-American community in the United States as part of the broader Asian-American community being a highly educated professional community and a kind of model minority from that that professional perception. But it's actually more accurate to describe the Filipino-American community as having a dual nature with highly educated professional workers, but also community members who may not be as highly educated and who are working at low-paid jobs. And so what I appreciate about what the work of the center is doing and also what she's doing is calling attention to this undervalued, underpaid, vulnerable part of the Filipino-American community. When we sometimes think about the caregivers who are on the front lines and who get attention, we tend to immediately think about nurses and doctors. Mm-hmm. And their role is absolutely important, but the role of home health aides, of personal attendants, of family members who are caring for you is just so important. And that's why I think your work, Michael, with Care Talk is so important, because it's creating more visibility for this group of people who are people. They're not solely workers, they're people. And I think PwC and Aquilina is doing that as well. And then the second thing that came to mind was just how undervalued our caregivers are. You know, our Filipino-American caregivers, but caregivers in general in the United States. And that is a question. That is an existential question for all of us in the 21st century, which is, how are we going to invest in our caregivers as workers, but as people, because our existence depends on it.
Right. That's so well said. Well, Professor Choi, it's been so great having you. Unfortunately, the Care Talk Radio Hour is just 1 hour. So I just wanted to wrap up our conversation, but give you a chance to share any final thought or message that you'd like to impart to the Care Talk listeners.
Sure. I think the message I would like to emphasize has to do with one of the reasons why I'm here on the show, and has to do with my admiration for the work of artists like you, Michael, in this Care Talk project, but many other artists, visual, documentary, musicians. All of us are struggling with our mental as well as physical health during this pandemic. And to value and to recognize the centrality of arts in our mental, physical, and overall well-being is just so important. And one of the reasons why it's important is because it gives a sense of humanity and dignity, a three-dimensional sense of the subject of art. Hmm. And in Care Talk, I think what you're doing when we listen to these segments of caregivers calling in and sharing their experiences, I think what you're doing is you're creating this three-dimensional, humane depiction of these caregivers as not solely workers or statistics, but as people, as our neighbors, our friends, and our family members. And that's just so important as we move forward in this time of so many different existential crises, is that we have to recognize our collective humanity.
Thanks again to my guest, Professor Catherine Siniza Choi. You can find out more about her work, research, and writing at ethnicstudies.berkeley.edu/people, or follow her on Twitter at @csinizachoi. That's it. @csinizachoi. Also, thank you to Akelina Soriano Versosa. To learn more about the Pilipino Workers Center of Southern California, or to make a much-needed donation in support of their work, please visit pwcsc.org. The music you heard was Mabuhay Boy by Vex Ruffin, Tomorrow by Fanny, and Stay With Me by Trackademics. Original Care Talk theme music by composer and artist Nathan Matthew David, with Angela Asistio, music supervisor. The Care Talk Radio Hour was made possible by Side Street Projects and Dublab, with special thanks to Emily Hopkins, Este Sanchez, Stephanie Aviles, and Rachel Day. To learn more about the Care Talk Project, visit caretalkproject.com. And to contribute your own caregiver stories, call or text the Care Talk hotline at 626-427-7293. For Care Talk, I'm Michael Rippins. Thank you for caring.